The jobs number disappoints.
And the unemployment rate is now 9.8%.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's December 3rd. Coming up, I'm going to take a quiz on obesity. And we're going to hear about the latest high-speed cell phone technology.
But first, to the jobs report. The Labor Department says the economy only added 39,000 jobs in November. That was far lower than expected. Let's bring in Chris Lowe. He's chief economist at FTN Financial, and he joins us now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Well, first, most people this morning are saying this is pretty bad news. You're usually able to find a silver lining. Do you see one here?
No. I wish I could give you a better answer than that. But look, going through the all the details in this number, that there's only 39,000 new jobs in November, 50,000 if you take government out of the equation. That's not enough, of course, to bring the unemployment rate down over time. We're looking at a 9.8% unemployment rate. It is the highest of the year. These are really ugly numbers.
Is this enough to say that we are in what a lot of people have been wondering if we're in, which is a jobless recovery?
Yeah, I think that's actually a perfect description of what's going on. You know, we call it a growth recession in the economics community. Growth because GDP is up, but it feels like a recession because there's nothing going on in the job market. And because the labor force grows over time, you've got this upward creep in the unemployment rate. It's a really frustrating situation.
Okay, a frustrating situation. I want to find out what's going on down in Washington, how they're reacting to this. Let's bring in our own Gregory Warner. Chris, stand by. Greg, how are people reacting down in the Capitol?
Well, no surprises, Jeremy. Republicans jumped to turn this news into a referendum on tax policy. John Boehner, the Republican House Speaker designate, issued a statement a little while ago. He criticized, quote, job-killing tax hikes. Democrats responded by pushing for an extension on jobless benefits, and President Obama will respond himself later this morning from the White House.
Okay, and then the other part of this is the Fed and the action that they took just recently. They took a real beating for pumping all this new money into the economy. Does a number like today's change the dynamic on that at all in terms of what you're hearing from people in Washington?
Well, sure. I called Karen Petru. She's managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. And she said, look, if you want to start talking about government and monetary stimulus and you draw that line to job growth, that line has to cross through Wall Street.
The financial market was, is, and for the foreseeable future will be a mess. And you don't get macroeconomic growth, you don't get recovery until you have a stable financial market and money is flowing back into the economy to fund new jobs.
All right, Chris Lowe, she is pointing the finger at Wall Street. You're here in New York. Do you think that investors, after seeing today's jobs number, are looking in the mirror for answers or are they looking down to Washington?
You know, it's funny. It's actually a remarkable reaction. The stock market's barely down, and the way we're reading that, talking to traders, is that the numbers were just so abysmal. They've decided to choose to believe that October's surprisingly good report is the truth, and November's, until they hear confirming data, is wrong. In the meantime, though, there is a push in New York for more help from D.C. We'd love to see relief on both, frankly, the unemployment benefits and taxes.
Okay, Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, as well as our own Gregory Warner. Thanks so much to you both.
Let's get another take on our top story with Gus Fauché, director of macroeconomics for Moody's Analytics. He's with us from just outside Philadelphia in Westchester, PA. Good morning, Gus.
Good morning.
Your initial reaction?
Very disappointing. We were expecting something closer to 150,000, and some of the other numbers were weak too in terms of average hourly earnings and the average work week.
Oh, I heard reports 150, as you say, or 200,000 or more, right?
Yeah, I mean, all the indicators were pointing to a very strong month for the labor market, and then to come in with this 39,000 figure is very disappointing.
So all the signs were pointing to something a lot more positive. Why are we still mired, Gus, in unusually high unemployment?
Well, I think there are a couple factors out there. I think businesses and consumers are still nervous. I think businesses may be still reluctant to hire. They're just anxious about what's going on out there. And then there may be some seasonal factors. It's tough to get things right around the holiday season when there's a lot of seasonal hiring. So it could be that the number next month will be stronger.
Hey, 20 seconds or so. What's it going to take to kick this recovery up a notch?
Well, I think two things that we need are an agreement on what we're going to do about the expiring Bush tax cuts, and then we need to get extended unemployment insurance benefits so those people who have lost their jobs can continue to spend.
So some legislation there, too. All right. Gus Fauché from Moody's Analytics, thank you.
Thank you.
The National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility votes today on its proposal to slash the federal deficit. This is the White House commission that's recommending cuts in just about everything, as well as some tax increases. Lobbyists and special interest groups have been slamming the proposal ever since it was released. Marketplace's David Gura spoke to a few of them.
It'll come as no surprise AARP doesn't want the government to mess with retirement benefits. The group represents millions of Americans over 50.
Social Security offers a modest benefit already. A 20% reduction or a greater reduction would significantly erode their retirement income.
Christina Martin-Favita directs the AARP's Economic Security Program.
We're a brand to be reckoned with.
Joe Stanton, a lobbyist for the National Association of Home Builders, doesn't want Congress to change the home mortgage deduction.
To do this to an industry that's already battered, it's just catastrophic.
And he says he's ready to fight.
We'll have access to Congress. We have our grassroots members already mobilized.
And with so many recommendations on the table, good luck finding someone happy with the whole thing. Justin Rubin is the president of Move On.
I think Congress should dump this document in the trash and then begin a real conversation about how to get our economy moving again.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Verizon is going to roll out its new faster wireless network on Sunday. It's called 4G. You probably heard it. Only thing is, it's not technically 4G, according to the United Nations agency that sets the global standards for these things. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
Lightning fast. Verizon 4G LTE.
Verizon advertises its version of 4G service as a bolt of lightning, but compared to true 4G, it's more like a sparkler. The UN has strict technical standards for a 4G network. Verizon doesn't meet them. Neither do any of the other wireless carriers advertising 4G. Charles Galvin is a tech analyst with Forrester Research. He says it's all about marketing.
Using the term 4G, as really a marketing term that means some kind of better service than what you get on 3G today.
Verizon says it doesn't matter what you call its new service. It's still a lot faster than 3G. Lindsay Notwell is in charge of marketing new Verizon technology. He says the new network will let you download things up to 10 times faster.
20 pictures in a minute, as opposed to 20 pictures in 10 minutes.
If you're thinking about holding out for the real 4G, don't. It won't be available until late in the next decade. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Yahoo has come out with its list of the top five search terms in 2010, Steve, which curiously, 2010 is still 4 weeks from being over, maybe something else will happen.
Yeah.
The usual suspects are in there, Lady Gaga, Kim Kardashian, and Miley Cyrus. Mm-hmm. Soccer's World Cup came in at number two.
Big deal back in the summer, yeah.
And Steve, what is the top Yahoo search item for 2010?
We need a drum roll. The BP oil disaster.
Aha.
Yeah. A lot of people, Jeremy, were transfixed by that underwater spill cam. That's what Yahoo said.
Oh, right. The spill cam.
Remember the spill cam that was deep beneath the surface of the Gulf of Mexico? Various ways, various people tried to plug that huge hole at the bottom of the Gulf, and they were paying attention to that.
And thankfully, they finally did plug that hole.
Yep. You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, the third day of December. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States.
There is a report out from the International Monetary Fund on real estate prices in China. It says the housing markets in large Chinese cities are becoming more and more disconnected from reality. As a matter of fact, some home prices in Shanghai and Beijing are on par with lofts in Manhattan. We've already seen what a U.S. housing bubble does to the global economy, but what about a Chinese bubble? Here's Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz.
First of all, let's get this straight. If there is a bubble in China, it hasn't yet burst. In fact, much of the IMF report actually says China's in good shape, but the IMF's crystal ball has been cloudy in the past. So let's assume China's property market is in trouble, like some economists say. If there's any impact on the U.S., says economist Michael Pettis, it'll start with China's real estate developers.
You've heard all the cliches about half of the building cranes in the world are in China and stuff like that. I don't know how true that is, but certainly real estate development has been a huge generator of growth in China.
Pettis says a property downturn in China might mean all those cranes would disappear from the skylines of cities across the country.
If it has a big impact on real estate development, then it would have an impact on commodity prices.
In other words, shipments of building materials would slow. Less demand would mean the prices of copper, steel, aluminum, you name it, would tank. And surprise, that would actually be great for the U.S. Cheaper building materials equals better business. Pettis says it'd be like a big tax cut. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
President Obama is expected to sign a $4.5 billion child nutrition bill that passed the U.S. House yesterday, part of First Lady Michelle Obama's campaign against childhood obesity. Now, this morning, we're going to talk about obesity as part of the Marketplace Globalist Quiz. And Stefan Richter is publisher and editor-in-chief of theglobalist.com, and he's with us right now. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning. So I take it you're ready for today's quiz.
I am ready. Give it to me.
Which of these countries has the highest obesity rate? The United States, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, or Russia? A nice global spread.
Let's see. All right, so it there's some great food in Mexico. But wow, the United States is home to fast food. Lots and lots of fast. I'm going to say the United States.
Yes, you are right. The United States leads the way. 46.3% of its population is considered obese.
Wow, that's 46%.
46%. And you know what's worse? There's a regional cluster here. You talked about Mexican food.
Yeah.
Mexico's number three behind Argentina, which is in number two. So that's the wrong kind of sense for the Western Hemisphere to lead the way globally.
How much higher, Stefan, is the obesity rate in the United States than the other countries, the number two, three, and you know the rest of them?
Number two and three are close together. And in fact, of the 20 G20 nations, three are over 30%. That's the U.S., Argentina, and Mexico. The club remains quite obese because seven of them are over 25% obese. Number four is Saudi Arabia, which I'd offered up, Australia, Canada, and the UK. Again, there's a little bit of a worrisome pattern because all of these four countries are great United States allies on foreign policy matters. So I hope nobody starts talking about an alliance of the obese and willing.
maybe some more calisthenics for them.
Yes, sport in high schools
that's
and
right.
Everywhere, and less Coca-Cola, that's and less snack food. People just can't resist this good stuff coming.
All right. Well, duly noted, Stefan Richter from The Globalist. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and stay slim.
We will try, Stefan Richter. For more insights, of course, check out theglobalist.com. Well, that global climate summit continues down in Cancun. So far, no new climate deal to report.
But far away from the summit, residents of a small island are taking matters into their own hands. Australia's Norfolk Island is going to try out what researchers are calling the world's first personal carbon trading scheme. Let's bring in one of the people involved down under. Professor Gary Egger of Southern Cross University joins me now from Sydney. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
First, tell us about Norfolk Island.
Well, Norfolk Island's about 1,600 kilometres off the mainland. There's almost 2,000 permanent residents, but there's up to 30,000 visitors per year who go out to see convict relics that were there when that was used as a penal settlement for Australia, basically. And Australia, as you know, was a penal settlement itself. So
right.
It's, you know, the worst of the worst went out to Norfolk Island.
So the worst of the worst are about to start the world's first personal carbon trading scheme. How does that work? What does that mean?
Well, the idea is that about 50% of carbon emissions come from individuals and households. So the personal carbon trading idea was that you give people a carbon card that's got a certain number of carbon units on it, which contract every year as you try and contract the amount of emissions. When they go and pay for their petrol, their fuel, and maybe even their food, they not only pay money, but it comes off their carbon card so that at the end of a set period, they can actually trade in what's left and make money back out of that.
So what's the fastest way to get your carbon emissions down in this plan? How would you get the most credits?
One way of getting your carbon emissions down is by reducing gas use in motor vehicles. One of the things that we'll be looking at, though, is also food, and we're trying to put a price on food in terms of its carbon cost. How much does it cost to get food to the island rather than make their own food out on the island at a very low carbon cost?
Professor Egger, I assume, as with any carbon trading scheme, that while some people are going to get money back because they reduce their carbon, some people are going to have to pay, right?
Ultimately, that may happen. They have 12 months to test it out without the punitive side of the payment. Uh-huh. And then there may be some payments for people who have to buy extra carbon units. Now, the price would go up as the carbon units go down.
Well, Gary Egger, professor of lifestyle medicine at Southern Cross University, thanks so much for talking to us and good luck with this experiment.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And finally, the High Speed Rail Authority in California, Steve, where you are, mm-hmm. has approved the first section of what eventually is going to be a bullet train that runs up and down the state. Mm-hmm. Well, the first track is going to run through about 65 miles of California's Central Valley. It's going to go from Borden to Corcoran. Do you have any idea where that is?
No, I know where the Central Valley is, and I can tell you driving through there, it's a large agricultural area.
Right. Yeah. But Borden and Corcoran, I don't know, maybe these are hotbeds for business activity. People are going to be racing back and forth. Well, critics are calling it the train to nowhere. And I guess the only good thing about it is at least it'll probably be pretty easy to get a seat.
Yeah, I'm sure.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.